It's Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in today for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. In the last few weeks, we've had conversations with city leaders and urban planning experts about the challenges that come with the housing market and the ripple effects that can have on a community. Today, we're turning our attention to commercial real estate, where some of the same factors are at play. A lot of retail stores closed in the past few years, but data show that the U.S. is on track to add more retail tenants than it's losing this year. Some of those storefronts that retailers had vacated have since been filled by non-traditional tenants like storage units and fitness centers. And the high costs of materials and borrowing is limiting the construction of new commercial properties. It's all changing the way some communities and businesses approach their economic development. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What kinds of new stores and businesses have you seen come into your area? Does your city have a lot of vacant storefronts? How do you want to see your community grow? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Elizabeth Brodick is the development director for the city of Wausau. She previously worked for the city of Eau Claire and led multiple business improvement districts in Milwaukee. Liz, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us is Gail Price, vice president of business banking for Blackhawk Bank. He was previously the economic development director for the city of Janesville. Gail, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Dean. Happy to be here.
Well, Liz, I mentioned some of the trends we're seeing in the commercial real estate market right now. I'm curious what it all looks like from where you're sitting in Wausau. What are you seeing in terms of commercial vacancies and new tenants?
So we are having, we definitely have some vacant office space, more than we did pre-pandemic. Hybrid work has been very much a trend that we're seeing. Luckily, our downtown storefronts are doing quite well overall. We have seen a few vacancies, but nothing to be very concerned about. We do have the benefit geographically of being the downtown hub in our seven municipality metro area. So that's been a benefit to us for sure. Some of the non-traditional storefronts that we've had for actually quite a while include a lot of photography businesses and a couple service businesses. So we are seeing a little bit more of that compared to retail. But really the thing that we are keeping the sharpest eye on right now is our office vacancy.
And Gail, same question for you. What are you seeing in your area in southern Wisconsin?
So interestingly enough, we've had a weakness on the office side. We don't have quite the corporate offices that maybe you see in Wausau. But, so there's been a less of an impact of the hybrid work environment, but we've been fortunate enough to have not, as a community, opened up much land for retail. So when there's been opportunities for backfill, it's been more on the traditional side. So earlier this year, Hy-Vee opened up a rehabilitated large-scale, Shopko, and that's been a successful reuse. We have had some smaller buildings that fit the mold to be able to do the climate controlled indoor storage. So that's been a positive because there hasn't been anything like that in the community. But we're still seeing a lot of interest in the smaller scale, 3,000 square foot user, small strip center kind of projects. We just had a recent transaction on a vacant parcel in our regional shopping area that they intend to roll those over for other smaller scale retail developments. In the downtown, we've had a really good successful run after some significant reinvestment in the downtown to the tune of about $30 million. So that's been a positive to help promote backfill of retail spaces within our downtown that in a lot of cases are challenging because what's the right use for the downtown and for that walking environment? Is there enough entrepreneurs in the community to step forward and say, hey, yeah, we've got a business idea that we want to fill this space with?
And Liz, when it comes to those business ideas and those new entrepreneurs that Gail mentioned, do you get a sense in Wausau that there's some hunger to fill those vacancies when they arrive or to fill hypothetical new construction for retail?
Absolutely. We also have the benefit of a business incubator in our community. So that's been wonderful. They just started up their boot camp program again. So it's a 12-week entrepreneurial program that takes people who are interested in opening a business through the basics of how to do that and what they can expect kind of going forward, whether they operate out of their home, out of a different type of facility, or out of a storefront. So that's been wonderful to kind of feed the ecosystem. And we do have definitely people who are, I mean, generally entrepreneurs, having been the downtown director for Wausau, we do get a lot of entrepreneurs in this community who are interested in opening brick and mortar. So it has been an absolutely wonderful feeding system. I can actually look out my office window right now and kind of see some of the people who have come through that entrepreneurial boot camp and been able to be successful in those storefront relocations. So it's definitely been a plus for us.
And Gail, interest rates, mortgage rates, they're on the high end right now. And I understand that commercial rental prices have also gone up for space around the country. I'm thinking that might not affect, you know, your Dollar Generals or your Starbucks that want to move into a community. They can weather that. But for a smaller business owner or someone who wants to start a business, those might be barriers to enter the brick and mortar physical space. Are you seeing that play out from your angle?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. When you think about an entrepreneur who maybe is in that incubator space in Wausau or maybe in a rental space in downtown Janesville, and they want to make that next step into the owner occupancy, control their destiny, their possible growth, et cetera. You know, it wasn't just a year and a half ago, interest rates on commercial loans were, you know, 3.5% to generally under 4%, and you're going to be 8.25%, 8.5% now. That's a significant shift in where they have to, you know, spend their monies, spend their revenues. And what does that look like when they look at the bottom line of their business growth? And that has to get passed on in one way or another if they're going to make that next step. And, you know, unfortunately, that's turning into a barrier. Now, there's certainly some programs out there like SBA 504, where you can leverage some federal government investment and reduce the down payment. But the challenge there is that the interest rates on those situations continue to rise up, where we might have had a conversation about a 504 in, say, March, and the rates today, because of the way treasuries are, they're 2% higher. So that's a risk, and that's a challenge right now in the marketplace and for all these communities that want to promote reinvestment.
We're talking with Gail Price right now, Vice President of Business Banking for Blackhawk Bank, and Liz Brodeck, Development Director for the City of Wausau, talking about the commercial real estate market and how to attract businesses to downtowns around Wisconsin. You can join in too at 800-642-1234. Liz, you've worked in Eau Claire before. You're in Wausau now. You've also worked in Milwaukee. And I'm curious, what is the biggest difference you've noticed in working in business development from a big city like Milwaukee to a mid-sized city like Wausau?
Oh, there are lots. it's really the biggest difference that I've seen is the goal of what the Business Improvement District exists to do. Generally in Milwaukee, it was, we focused so much on safe and clean streets and, making sure that storefronts were filled. It was kind of more basic on the, if you think about like a Maslow's hierarchy of, community development, it was more on the base level of like, we need to just make sure that this is a good, sustainable environment for businesses to operate within. In Wausau, the city does a lot more of that type of work in terms of ensuring trash is picked up, graffiti is removed, things like that. And also there's just a lot less of it in a smaller city. And then here, the bid really exists to help drive foot traffic to businesses. So it was always, you know, we'd always say like, our job is to get people downtown into the streets on the sidewalks, and then the business owners need to make sure that they are coming through those doors. So working with them on different promotional activities, events, things like that. So it was a little bit more on the social, like in Wausau, it's a little bit more on the social side of things, the cultural development. And in Milwaukee, we certainly did a lot of that because that's kind of where a lot of my passion lies. But it was a lot more on the very like basic kind of physical maintenance of the space. So a little bit different focus.
And Gail, when it comes to those larger retailers, those chain stores that might move into a suburban area, what draws them to like a midsize or a smaller city in the state?
So much of the time it's being able to have a parcel or building available in the regional shopping area. So many of these larger retailers have metrics that are based on regional draw. They like to compete right across the street from one another because there is a large draw from outside the community. So they're hedging a bet that they're going to bring people from the surrounding communities into Janesville. And that's been a challenge in Janesville because we have the south side of the community that has no grocery store right now. The Pick and Save closed several years ago, and there's not been interest on a larger scale for a grocery to return to that area. So it does make it challenging because as an economic development professional, when we were trying to court a grocery into that area, usually they would point towards the regional shopping area as their desired location. So it does make it a bit of a challenge in smaller communities like this.
We're talking with Gail Price, Vice President of Banking for Business at Blackhawk Bank, and Wausau Development Director Liz Brodeck about the retail and commercial real estate market in Wisconsin and how it's shaping local downtowns. You can join in too at 800-642-1234. What kind of businesses do you want your city to attract? Do you like the direction your community is going in that area? How much vacancy do you see in your local downtown when it comes to storefronts and other property? And if you are in the business community yourself, we'd love to hear what you think. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up the conversation on commercial real estate and what it means for economic development in Wisconsin communities. Our guests are City of Wausau Development Director Liz Brodeck and former Janesville Economic Development Director Gail Price. You can join in the conversation, too, at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the commercial development happening in your city? Do you like the businesses coming in? Would you like to see something different? Let us know at 800-642-1234. Now, Liz, I think if you ask most people, they'd want to see a healthy variety of businesses in their downtown. They wouldn't want to see, a full row of gift shops that are similar or a full row of bars. Is there a way for development departments to encourage that variety, or is it just a matter of letting competition sort things out?
You are 100% right that mixed use is best downtown. And there, that's a tough question because it's generally something that is a private, two private parties making a transaction together. So unless there's a zoning compliance issue, there's not really a lot that our local government steps in to assist with. It does help that like we are very involved. Both the mayor and I sit on the Wausau River District, which is our downtown organization board. And so we are, privy to what storefronts are open and who's coming in where and things like that. But for instance, like we have a new business that is hoping to come in downtown, filling up what is technically one storefront, kind of looks like two, but they need like a zoning change. So, my assistant city planner came and kind of explained the situation, and we could have said something like, oh no, it's not really worth pursuing. But instead it was like, no, this is absolutely like a really, really cool idea. We need to go about whatever method we need to do to, create a new zone, new zoning code or new type of commercial code to allow this type of business in. So we have some influence in that way, but that's generally pretty much the extent of it. I mean, obviously, the extent of it technically, on the personal side of things, of course, like we have another one of my employees is the liaison to our entrepreneurial and education center. So it's, making those types of connections just among people and entities that know each other and work alongside of each other to say, oh, well, you know, we have this storefront and I know you guys are looking for something. So it's not really in the, like I said, the technical aspect of things, but it is very much in the, you know, social capital of exchanging information and knowing what is going to work well in a storefront versus what would be better, you know, in an upper story or outside of the downtown realm.
And Gail, we are seeing national data showing that commercial real estate construction is slowing down. How does that affect business development in your area?
Well, it definitely makes it more challenging to move forward. When you have interest rates that are higher, it really diminishes the amount of new investment, but those are also opportunities to help promote reuse of existing buildings, especially in the downtown. Now, hopefully the communities have some kind of assistance that is available through tax increment financing or some other rehabilitation fund to help promote that, because obviously one of the things that can be a hindrance is updating a building to current building codes when it was built, say, 125 years ago. So those are all kind of things that end up having to be a challenging balance to help promote that. But when we look at that whole picture, the financing piece tends to be a big gateway to preventing people making these investments and making those leaps.
And Liz, you mentioned earlier that office space has taken a bit of a hit in your area, that there's a bit of a loss of people due to the pandemic and working from home. How are you looking at those spaces from your angle?
It depends on the location. We have one, for instance, we actually have one office building downtown that is completely vacant. So there are the ownership group is pursuing a lot of different options. And then we have some just more underutilized office space. So those, you know, that's a matter of really recruiting office tenants who can use it and who would be well situated in a downtown area, or who could benefit from foot traffic, who could benefit from the proximity of to different uses and different types of storefronts. It makes it a more attractive office space overall to be located in downtown. So that's been helpful in terms of, you know, recruiting more service and business workers. For that completely vacant building, there has been talk of a lot of different things. And of course, you know, office to residential conversion has come up in conversations, and that is, you know, extremely difficult to do, not just for the reasons that Gail had mentioned earlier in terms of like the financing structures and things like that. But then you think about the codes that are required for office building versus residential use. And it's basically, it's kind of constructing twice, because you have to demolish part of the building to then upgrade to different standards that are needed for different code enforcements and things like that. And then you have to reconstruct, like put the building essentially back together. So that's been generally prohibitively expensive, not just here, but throughout the country. I know I've been keeping tabs on how many office conversions are happening and how many are happening successfully. And I just read of one that was a conversion that had already happened in Phoenix that now is being foreclosed on with a loan that I have to believe was it was similar to the cost of new construction, just because it's, like I said, it is prohibitively expensive generally to make those things work, and especially then with any type of affordable rent or attainable rent. So depending on the building, depending on the location, can be different remedies to kind of reoccupy that space.
And as we start to wrap up, Gail, I'm curious, what are you watching for next? What is the factor, the indicator that you're really tracking as it relates to business development?
That's a really
try to pick
question.
Just one, right?
it is difficult. I think a lot of it has already started. You know, the cost of construction has slid back. You know, the pandemic was wreaking havoc on construction projects. You know, we've seen that stabilize right now. I think if the Fed steps forward with reduction of rates, that's going to help promote more development and reinvestment. But there's a number of factors that are, I think, going to have to come into play. there's no way that rents are going to catch up with the cost of capital right now. When we talk about the cost of residential occupancy, there's no way that it's going to catch up with that cost of funds. So my hope is that cost of funds comes down. We continue in Wisconsin to have this huge need for residential housing, for workforce, and to attract workforce. I hear this all the time from employers in the community. We need to see more residential development to help sustain business growth in our state.
And Liz, in our last minute, what is at the top of your agenda in Wausau?
More residential development is our department's number one priority. We just had a regional housing study done, and we are 525 units short for 2025 needs. So we are pursuing heavily residential development. For all the reasons Gail mentioned, it is very difficult to get the financing to make any sense right now and keep it within affordable rates. So those are the biggest things that I'm kind of keeping an eye on. You know, also our low unemployment rate and what that means for all of the wraparound services. We have a 2.3% unemployment rate in Wausau right now. So besides housing, which is a huge need for employers in our area, it's transportation and childcare is a very, very big one. So in terms of we're not doing even a lot of attracting businesses right now because we still have one of the last counts I heard was 6,000 open jobs in Marathon County. So it doesn't really make sense to attract more jobs that would cannibalize our existing businesses. So we're really focused on finding the things that can free up the labor force, like housing and transportation and childcare, and then also home growing those businesses. So focusing a lot on homegrown, entrepreneurial, and innovative development.
Thanks to our guests, Elizabeth Brodeck, Development Director for the City of Wausau, and Gail Price, Vice President of Business Banking for Blackhawk Bank. They're with us to talk about the real estate market for retail businesses and how it affects communities around Wisconsin. I'm Dean Kinetter. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in today for Rob Ferret. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court announced something of a first a week ago. The justices released a code of conduct document, stating that while the court has been following common law ethics rules from a variety of sources, quote, the absence of a code has led in recent years to the misunderstanding that the justices of this court, unlike all other jurists in this country, regard themselves as unrestricted by ethics rules, unquote. That announcement, though, didn't come until after reporting from ProPublica about luxury travel by some justices and other campaigns to influence the court, which were previously undisclosed. Add to the mix pressure from Senate Democrats related to transparency and ethics rules. We're going to get into what all the justices included in this ethics code and what's missing. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. How ethical do you see the Supreme Court as being as of late? Do you think they need to codify a set of ethical guidelines? What questions do you have about what's in this code, what's not in it? What's your response to the court issuing this code of ethics? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Sarah Benesch is Associate Professor and Chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, where she researches judicial decision-making and court legitimacy. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, what was your reaction when this ethics code came out from the court about a week ago?
Well, I think there's some cause to be, you know, sort of excited about the fact that the court was listening. So it certainly heard complaints by politicians, concerns raised by the public, and commentators' criticisms of the court's seeming lack of some ethical guidelines. And so the fact that they responded is a big deal. But I think when you read the actual statement and the actual code, you come away a little bit maybe less impressed with their work.
Yeah. What do you think is, first off, what's missing from this document?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's clearly the case that there's no enforcement mechanism here. So the Supreme Court has not offered us any way to make a complaint or allowed any other lawyer or justice to make a complaint against another justice for behaving in ways that are contrary to the code. So that's, I think, the first thing that you notice. I think the second thing, though, is, and maybe this is the first thing you notice, is right on the front, there's this little statement, and you quoted from it in your introduction. And the statement reads to me as sort of a, okay, you're complaining, and we hear you complaining, and so here's what we've already been doing, and stop misunderstanding, you know, our actions. And so it reads as a very sort of, I don't know, I want to say maybe condescending a bit, saying that, you know, the Supreme Court should be trusted to do these things, and oh, some people are complaining, and so we're going to put some of these things in writing.
And could you talk a bit more about what you see as the motivations for the court to create this document? Why right now?
Well, as you mentioned, the Senate is talking about these ethics considerations, and we're considering some subpoenas for some of the supporters of Thomas and Alito that have led to some of those problematic relationships. And so I think that, you know, they are seeing the political action in Congress. I think they also have concerns about the separation of powers, and some of those concerns may be warranted. And so they wanted to act before Congress attempted to act to constrain their behavior. And then I do think that, you know, especially the Chief Justice, but all the justices are concerned with their legitimacy. And so it seems as if this is a bit of a reaction to some pretty low poll numbers that the court has been experiencing for the last term or so. And I think this is sort of a way to try to allay the concerns of public about their behavior and to sort of put put these kinds of allegations and concerns to rest so that people can start to trust the institution again.
And it is pretty rare for there to be a unanimous decision of any kind from the Supreme Court these days. But here, all the justices are signing on to this code of ethics. What do you make of that that consensus from the justices?
Yeah, I think the unanimous nature is important. I think they had to come out with a statement that they all agreed with. But I also think that that's likely why some of the statement is much more vague than it might have been had there been, you know, some dissensus allowed. So, you know, there are a lot of the words in the statement, for example, talk about, you know, should rather than shall. Some of the words talk about using specific things as guidance. And so I think the vague wording of a lot of the code, although it relies pretty heavily on the lower court code, but some of the wording, I think, is likely a result of that desire for consensus. And so when you want to have a document that all nine can sign on to, you know, you might have to have a document that's a little less specific than maybe some of the justices would have preferred.
We're talking with Sarah Benesch right now, associate professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee, looking at a newly released Code of Ethics from the U.S. Supreme Court. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. And let's go to the phones right now. We have Ted with us in Monaco. Hi, Ted.
I think it's well documented throughout history that the Supreme Court, not only being the last word of the law, the most trusted branch, they definitely have always been the most ethical branch of government. And the idea of the Senate, where all the, you know, overlooked insider trading and all the outright crime in the executive branch, the idea of some other body of government trying to impose, they're the one that started this, to get rules on the Supreme Court, that's a joke. And it's just some propagandist trying to change the subject because they don't agree with some recent Supreme Court rulings.
Ted, thanks for the call. And Ted's right. The Supreme Court, not the only branch of government that faces concerns about corruption and ethics. Sarah, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think the oftentimes when we criticize the Supreme Court, the real criticism is that we don't like the decisions that they're making. It's less about the process and procedure. And there are, as I mentioned, separation of powers concerns. And so the Supreme Court is the court of last resort. There is no authority that can overturn its decisions. And so, you know, we probably can't expect the court to cede control over its activities outside of the bench to one of the other co-equal branches. And so, you know, that I think that separation of powers argument was very important to the Supreme Court, which is another reason why they got ahead of Congress. But I also think there's some real concerns about ethics violations here, especially when we have an unelected body that has life tenure, right? So if we're upset with some of the problems in Congress, we can vote them out, right? We can't do that with the Supreme Court. And I think, frankly, people have higher expectations for the Supreme Court in terms of their honesty and ethics.
And some of the incidents that were reported on by ProPublica and other outlets had to do with Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, accepting luxury travel and gifts from conservative donors. And that was part of the impetus for people really pushing for some kind of ethics code from the Supreme Court. Does this new ethics code laid out by the court address those kind of instances? Would it do anything about that?
I think it does. Yeah. I think the code says explicitly that the Supreme Court is going to abide by those lower court codes from the judicial conference. And part of the judicial conference's codes talk about the disclosure of financial gifts. And in fact, it recently made a revision in reaction to some of these questions about the justices to define what personal hospitality means. So there's a exemption to reporting requirements for what they call personal hospitality. And so the question, especially in the Justice Thomas case, was whether or not personal hospitality extended to something like a luxury cruise or a stay at a luxury resort. And so the judicial conference has decided that what they mean by personal hospitality is the justices don't have to disclose when they go over to a friend's house for dinner. We want them to be able to have normal lives and lead, you know, public normal lives. But it does not exempt from disclosure the kinds of trips that Justice Thomas went on or the kinds of trips that Justice Alito went on. And so I think it's implicitly saying that what they did should have been disclosed. But certainly, again, there's no enforcement mechanism here, so there's no going back. The code only applied to the Supreme Court once it decided it applied to the Supreme Court. And so to the extent that those behaviors are problematic, they're sort of outside the purview of this new guidance.
And as I read through this document that's been put out by the court, I see the word should a lot. Mm-hmm. And I am not a legal expert, but I imagine that justices choose their words pretty carefully. Is that use of the word should rather than shall or must significant?
Yes. The language in this whole code of conduct is significant because it is, you know, as we talked about, a unanimous document that ends up then, because of the unanimity, being a little bit vague and a little bit careful with some of its language. So should and shall is a big distinction, right? So when you say someone should do something or ought to do something, that's much different than saying that someone shall do something. And so there's a lot of room throughout the document for justice choices and a lot of focus on knowingly engaging in certain behaviors. And so there's a section on financial interests. And so instead of just, you know, sort of saying if there's a financial interest, the justices may not sit on a case. It says that if the justices knowingly engage with a case in which they have a conflict, you know, so there's this sort of additional question, not only of should they have gotten involved, but also did they know specifically that they were getting involved in something that they potentially had a conflict on.
We're talking about what prompted the new code of conduct the Supreme Court released just last week and what's in it. Sarah Benish is our guest. She's associate professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. We want you to be part of the conversation, too, at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? What's your perception of the Supreme Court these days? Does this new ethics code move the needle on that at all? Do you think it's necessary or is it not needed? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Sarah Benish, associate professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. We're talking about a new ethics code the Supreme Court justices formally adopted last week. We're also taking your comments or questions at 800-642-1234. Let us know if you think there's a need for an ethics policy by the Supreme Court. How do you feel about the High Court these days? Do you have faith in the justices? That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Nancy with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. I'm calling to say that in the last 2 years, I read an article in the Milwaukee Journal about the fact that the justices at any time can redecorate their offices, including the purchase of any kind of office furniture or equipment they feel they need, and including specially made draperies for the windows. They can do this without having to go through any kind of a bidding process. They just find what they want and buy it, and it's paid for. And this article also pointed out the fact that there are large rooms within the justice building that they rent out for anniversary parties of all kinds, small conventions, weddings, birthday parties, anything they want. They charge the kinds of rent they want, and they get to keep the money, and none of this is passing through any set of financial books. And when I read that article, it made me even more a disillusioned American citizen than I already was.
Nancy, thank you for the call. Sarah, is that something you know about? And what do we know about ethics for personal office expenses for the court?
I don't know much about that, unfortunately, no. I know that the new code of ethics or code of conduct does talk about use of the chambers for things other than judicial duties, and it seems fairly negative about using them for anything but writing opinions and working on cases. But the actual oral argument chamber of the court is sometimes used in some ceremonial sort of extrajudicial ways, and that has gotten some attention in the past as well. So Justice Thomas, for example, holds the Horatio Alger Association induction there. And that's a big, you know, draw for people who are members of that society. And that has been questioned as being potentially problematic in terms of ethics.
Nancy, thanks for that call. And Sarah, we mentioned earlier how this code of conduct helps to define the personal hospitality aspect that we discussed earlier. Are there other things that are significant in here that you see this code laying out that the justices can't do?
I think the Chief Justice or the unanimous court, I guess, altogether lays out that a lot of the things in this code of conduct are not new. And I think that's fair. I think a lot of the items in the code of conduct are items that have always existed in terms of their application to lower court judges. And what the court is doing now is saying, okay, the Supreme Court will also be bound by these various conduct sort of guidelines. But I think what's, you know, maybe, you know, so I think we focus a little bit on that financial activities section with the personal hospitality and with financial disclosures. But there's also a very big piece of the code of conduct that is devoted to recusal decisions. And that's a pretty big deal in courts as well, where judges and justices decide for themselves whether or not they can impartially participate in a particular case given, you know, some sort of perceived or real conflict of interest. And so that section of the code of conduct is an important section, and it's also relatively distinguished from the same section that applies to lower court judges.
Another issue people have been talking about in the past couple of years regarding the court is the activity of spouses, particularly because Ginny Thomas, wife of Clarence Thomas, longtime conservative activist and organizer, we've seen her name attached to communications with the White House on January 6th. Is there anything in this code of ethics about spouses?
Yes, there are some pieces of the code that talk about financial disqualification and about recusal that do relate to conflicts of interest that spouses hold. There's nothing in there about that would sort of pertain to Ginny Thomas's political action, but there are some aspects of the code that apply to the justice, but also to the justice's immediate family, including spouse, children, parents, and so on.
And this code, Sarah, as we mentioned, doesn't have a lot of enforcement teeth written into it. I'm curious, though, what could that look like? What could a hypothetical enforcement mechanism look like for a code of ethics for the highest court in the country?
I don't know. I think that's tricky. You know, so to the degree that some of the aspects of the code of conduct are based on U.S. statutes, it is, you know, potentially possible for the attorney general to bring charges. Now, that's probably never going to happen and never has happened in the past. And because the statutes don't explicitly often refer to the Supreme Court and its justices, that would be, you know, there'd only be a very limited place for that kind of an enforcement. And so what the court suggests in this document is that they will rely on the guidance of various bodies, including their Office of Legal Counsel and the Judicial Conference and the various subcommittees of the Judicial Conference. So I think, you know, a lot of legal scholars have been sort of thinking about ways in which the court's ethics could be, or their code of conduct could be implemented. And as we said at the outset, it's really difficult with separation of powers issues, unless the court were to create some sort of an ethics committee where claims or questions about disclosure or about recusal could go to that committee. Any other solution really kind of runs into these questions of separation of powers.
And you mentioned earlier, Sarah, that public trust in the court has been falling for a while. We've seen that in polling here in Wisconsin and nationwide, and that predates reporting on hospitality activities from Thomas, Alito, et cetera. Do you think this code of ethics is likely to move the needle on that public trust issue?
I think it depends on how widely the code of ethics is covered. You know, so I think it's great that you're talking about it on your program. I think it's really hard for the public to keep up with events in government, and this could be seen as a very sort of specific and esoteric sort of question, right? Whether or not the Supreme Court has a code of ethics might not be something that plays really strongly across the electorate. So we've seen some legitimacy losses at the Supreme Court. We've seen confidence lower than it's been for a long time. Generally speaking, scholars attribute that to politicization and to political polarization. And I think those explanations for the Supreme Court's lagging numbers are probably a little bit more compelling than an explanation based on ethics. Although, you know, it's been recent enough that we don't have a whole lot of poll data on whether or not people are adversely impacted by these stories about wealthy donors and so forth and the interaction of justices with them. So, you know, I guess the main thing is that, you know, we have to think about what the public is likely to hear and engage with. And the public writ large may not be particularly interested in a code of ethics for the Supreme Court. It might not be something that's really salient to them.
And what are you keeping your eye on next, Sarah, when it comes to either reaction to this code or ethical issues facing the court?
I think we've already seen some change in response to these new understandings of reporting requirements. And I think that's a positive development. You know, so Thomas has recused in a case involving January 6th. Thomas has also disclosed some trip information that he hadn't disclosed before. And so it's possible that the existence of the code and the discussion of the code and this sort of, you know, conscious awareness of the impact of Supreme Court behavior or the potential impact of Supreme Court behavior on the way people see the institution could have a really positive effect in the long term, keeping the justices just sort of in a self-enforcement kind of way, more aware of the activities that they're engaging in and what those might look like outside the court.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. But Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. Anytime.
Sarah Benesch is associate professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. We talked with her about what prompted the U.S. Supreme Court to adopt a formal code of conduct last week, what's in it, and what questions still remain about how it will be enforced. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, the State Geological and Natural History Survey gives us some important data about our shared resources, including groundwater. We'll hear from the new state geologist about what's at the top of her agenda. Plus, two economic development leaders join the show from northern Wisconsin. That's coming up tomorrow morning after 7 o'clock on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Today is Funky Drummer Day. We're celebrating the anniversary of the most sampled music track of all time being recorded in 1970. That's James Brown's Funky Drummer. Specifically, it's the drum beat by Clyde Stubblefield. He joined the JBs in 1965 and laid down some of the greatest funk beats of all time. And for almost 50 years, before his death in 2017, he lived and performed in Madison, Wisconsin. The Funky Drummer has been sampled hundreds of times and helped create the sound for hip-hop and rap. You'll know it when you hear it. One, two, three, four, get it! Ain't it funky? Ain't it funky?